Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary Research Branch. Welcome to the latest of the Library's Vital Issue Seminars and Lectures. Our speaker this morning is Professor Stephen Duckett, who's talking about opportunities to reduce the cost of the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. On Monday, the Grattan Institute and Professor Duckett published the report Australia's Bad Drug Deal, High Pharmaceutical Prices. And it certainly appears to be an issue with some fairly close examination, given the, I understand, about $9 billion in government revenue that goes into the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. And I also read that around 194 million prescriptions are subsidised through the PBS, amounting to about 9 prescriptions per year for each person in Australia. Professor Duckett probably needs limited introduction. I think he's fairly well known already, but he's held top operational and policy leadership positions in healthcare in both Australia and Canada, including as Secretary of what's now the Commonwealth Department of Health and Ageing. He studied economics at ANU and health administration at the University of New South Wales. He's also been awarded a Doctor of Science by the University of New South Wales and elected as a Fellow of the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia. I ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Duckett.
Thanks very much, and I'd like to start by acknowledging that I'm giving a speech on what was Aboriginal land, and that these acknowledgements of country are really important, especially in talks about the health sector, because still today Aboriginal people have significant difference in life expectancy from non-Aboriginal people, and so that when we hear these acknowledgements, we need to remember that what the dispossession and the disadvantage that has occurred over the centuries has meant. This report came out of a stream of work we're doing at the Grattan Institute on the issue of waste in the health sector, and this component was looking at high input prices as an example of waste. It's not the only area we're going to be looking at, but we thought it was timely to start with this one. Please feel free, if you wish, to interrupt as we go along, but we're going to have time for questions at the end. We're going to look at five main areas, basically a bit about pharmaceutical costs, but that's mostly known, a bit about what Grattan Institute did and how the current pharmaceutical pricing works, where we think it should change, better way to purchase, and what some of the reactions to our report has been. So this graph is the graph of total expenditure on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme in real terms. You can see that it's escalating pretty significantly. Most of the spending is by pensioners and healthcare card holders. This other spending includes people who have hit the concession, the safety net. And so the scheme, in terms of its incidence, is actually quite well targeted. And there's also a significant patient contribution. So we're interested in whether there's anything could be done to reduce that total expenditure. And what we see when we look at that is that 5 years ago or so, Australia was amongst the best in the world in negotiating prices for pharmaceuticals. The Productivity Commission did a report back in 2000 which said that we were amongst the best in the world, not quite the best, but pretty close to the best. But over the last decade or so, we've lost our advantage, and from ranking in the top three and everybody basically spending more in terms of prices relative to Australia, we've now dropped to a situation where the European countries especially are now spending less in terms of prices, and we're now in the bottom three in terms of rankings. It's important to recognise that there are two basic markets we're talking about in the pharmaceutical business, and these work quite differently. The first is the patented drugs. These are drugs which are still recouping the cost of the investment and the research and development, and off-patent drugs. And in patented drugs, they're essentially by definition sole supplier arrangements. There's only one supplier because they're under patent, and there's no patient choice. And when you listen to some of the responses to my report, they say, oh, look, our report is going to lead to no patient choice and sole supplier arrangements. Well, I forget that's actually part of the market for one set sort of drug. The other is, of course, off-patent drugs, where there's the potential for multiple suppliers and very low marginal cost of production, and so you have the potential for competition and the potential for price reductions. The policy issues in the two markets are actually quite distinct. Obviously, in both in the patented drugs, there's the listing decision, which is whether the incremental benefit is worth it, and that actually continues to be an issue after the drug is introduced, and this issue of substitution is a very important one. And of course, what should the subsidised price be? And that is particularly the issue with respect to the off-patent drugs or the generics. So our report is about pricing, and we've not addressed a whole lot of issues. We were criticised for not addressing patent law extension and so on, but we're essentially about pricing, and as this drug suggests, that's part of the experimental science. So what did we do? We identified the 50 drugs that are the highest volume on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme and the 50 drugs which are the highest in total spending on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, and we attempted to compare the prices paid by those by Pharmac in New Zealand, the prices paid for those in Western Australia for Western Australian public hospitals, and the prices paid in another state in Australia, and we got the data from that second state on the condition of confidentiality, so we can't tell you which state it is. There was not there was an overlap. There were 62, in the case of New Zealand, 62 identical drugs. In the unnamed state, 59 identical drugs, and in Western Australia, 39 identical drugs. There are 11 drugs for which we could find substitutes in New Zealand, and 2 drugs which weren't on the schedule in New Zealand at all. And so, again, a criticism, as you'll see, of our report was that there was reduction in access in New Zealand, and that's actually represented here. So what did we actually find? This graph shows the difference in multiples of the drugs we could look at. The chart represents 58 identical doses, drug-dose combinations, and only 39 of those are displayed because there just wasn't room to. On average, and this is comparing what we call the benchmark, that is the best price achieved by either Western Australia or the unnamed state or New Zealand, on average, the pharmaceutical benefit scheme pays 8 times as much as our benchmark. So if someone says to you that the prices in the pharmaceutical benefit scheme are very good, well, they are very good, but not necessarily for the taxpayer or for the consumer. So in this particular case, this is the only case where Western Australia was able to negotiate or tender for or get the cheapest price. For this particular drug, Western Australian public hospitals got a particularly good deal, or the pharmaceutical benefit scheme got a particularly bad deal. The price on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme was 62 times what Western Australian public hospitals pay, compared to an average of 8 times for all drugs. And this drug is, New Zealand was the cheapest, so that is Western Australia. The orange ones are New Zealand the cheapest, and the black ones are the unnamed states, unnamed state prices. And so you can see there's, by and large, we're not doing too well. And what's more important, and so what are the savings that are achievable from this? If we simply adopted Western Australian prices for exactly the same drugs, no difference in the drug, the generic equivalents and so on, the taxpayer or total spending, there'd be a saving of about $790 million a year. That's, forget about New Zealand, forget about anything else, just use Western Australia, we'd save $790 million. If we chose New Zealand as our comparator, we'd save $1.7 billion or so, with some of it coming from patented drugs and substitutions, and the majority of it coming from generics. So as you see, the majority of the savings that we talk about come from generic drugs. What's most interesting is that the pharmaceutical benefit scheme performs worst where it's most important. And so if we look at the highest volumes of drugs, for the 10 drugs which are the highest volume on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, we pay on average 12 and a bit times what New Zealand pays. For the highest, for the next 10 in terms of volume, we pay just under 8 times what New Zealand pays. And we drop down for the group 40 to 50, paying twice and a bit times what New Zealand pays. The same sort of pattern for the high total cost. For the 10 drugs which are the highest total cost on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, we pay more than 10 times what New Zealand pays. And to give you an example of atorvastatin, using data from October 2012, in Australia, pharmaceutical benefits scheme paid $51.59 for a box of 30, 40 milligrams. In New Zealand, they paid $5.80 for a box of 90. The same manufacturer, it's Pfizer in both cases. If Australia paid the same price, if PBS paid the same price as New Zealand, you'd save $1.4 million a day. And so too with consumers. If consumers, if the atorvastatin was listed on the PBS at the New Zealand price, then consumers who aren't healthcare card holders, aren't on the safety net, would pay only $14.10 to get a box of tablets versus the $36.10 that they pay under the co-payment arrangements now, a saving of $22 per box of tablets. And the same is true in Western Australia. If a patient in Perth could get the same prices as a public hospital in Perth gets, they would save $19 out of pocket every time they filled their prescription. And these are the drugs. So you can see there are these nine drugs here, or five drugs there, where the saving was more than $20 and $15. So there's significant savings on a number of drugs. This is out-of-pocket cost savings for individual consumers. So what are the problems of the process? Why did we get in this situation? We were so good, we're not now. We think there are problems with the whole process of setting the prices. And there is existing policy called expanded and accelerated price disclosure, which doesn't work terribly well. Obviously, there's embedded politics, there's an agreement, and there's timid price cuts on new generics, which we will explain as we go along. So there's this thing called expanded and accelerated price disclosure. And the first element of this is that you collect information from the drug companies on their price disclosure. And this builds in a minimum delay of 12 months between when a discount is given by the pharmaceutical manufacturers to when the data is collected. The next stage, and then they collect the price disclosure data and they send it in. Now, bearing in mind that practically all inventory control these days is computerised, it doesn't seem to me legitimate to have a 12-month minimum delay. The second component of the so-called accelerated price disclosure is that a consultant is hired to actually get the spreadsheet and turn it into advice and then make a decision. And that takes 6 months, which is another extraordinary delay. So the whole process is proceeding at snail's pace. So what has been the impact of this expanded and accelerated price disclosure? Well, here is the price of these drugs as they were in the 2011-2012 schedule, and there have been some reductions introduced as a result of price disclosure, and they bring the price down actually quite significantly in some cases, in fact in one and a half cases, but not so significantly in other cases. These are the drugs that are actually in our... These drugs are the drugs that were impacted by price disclosure and were in our data set of 75 drugs that we started off with. So when the government says that actually, and the pharmaceutical industry says, that actually price disclosure is bringing prices down, they're actually right. It is, and you can see it in this graph. The question is it bringing the prices down far enough? And so this diamond here is actually the benchmark price. And so you can see that the proportionate reduction is nowhere near sufficient, except in one case, in nowhere near sufficient generally to bring the prices as a result of price disclosure down to what the benchmark prices ought to be. What is the current process? It's a complicated process for listing drugs on the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, which involves a whole lot of negotiations and prices and submissions and so on. It includes the Pharmaceutical Benefits Pricing Authority, and I'll come back to that. But at the end of the day, the decision is made by a politician, either by the health minister or by cabinet. And so you have politics embedded in the whole process. The Pricing Authority, despite its grandiose title, is in fact a committee of the Department of Health and Ageing, which has representatives of the industry, actually on the committee of two of the six people, so it's got politics embedded in it, and there's politics at the end of the whole process. And the whole framework is governed by a memorandum of understanding with Medicines Australia, which gives a deal to Medicines Australia which says the Commonwealth undertakes not to implement new policy to generate price-related savings from the PBS during a five-year period. And you'll note that over this five-year period, Australia slipped from being one of the best in terms of negotiating good prices to being one of the worst. And it may be because other countries were introducing new policies at the time, as we'll see. Another issue is this timid pricing for generic, the new generics. So when a drug comes off patent in Australia, there's a 16% mandate reduction just like that when the drug comes off patent. You can compare that with these other countries, where the European countries where 30, 40, 50% reduction. The 9 of the 10 Canadian provinces have just announced an 82% reduction for 6 generics. And so our 16% is looking quite timid. So what do we think should happen? What we recommend in our report is getting the politics right, that the government should make a decision about what the budget is, and we should have an independent governance process where there's a political decision about the funds available, and then the pricing and access decisions are based on clinical value, and that's a decision made by experts. The second stage of our reform was to suggest at least a 50% cut for new generics and benchmark pricing thereafter, and that would generate about $1.3 billion, we estimated, just on the drugs that we looked at. Those drugs accounted for about 46% of PBS spending, so there may well be bigger savings when you applied that sort of policy across the whole of the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. We suggested wider application of therapeutic premiums for substitute drugs, which is likely to generate $550 million. We said this was an indicative estimate because there needs to be further clinical evaluation and assessment of that stage. So that's what we said. In terms of who is the benchmark, the PBS is the benchmark in actually five of the drugs we looked at, so they can actually negotiate good prices. Western Australia one, unnamed state, but most of the drugs were, the benchmark was New Zealand. The New Zealand and the unnamed state were actually quite close. Most of the savings came from identical pharmaceuticals, so no change in what is actually provided, and most of the savings came from generic drugs. So we suggested a three-stage process, get the framework right, get the organisation right, and you do that before the agreement with Medicines Australia expires. Once the agreement with Medicines Australia expires, you can then introduce your new pricings, new policies, cutting the generics especially, price benchmarking, and then sometime after that, a third stage of reform, broadening the therapeutic group premium. So what were the reactions to our report? Well, one of them was this one. If you want to, a how-to guide for turning your country into that, a third, was actually a word, but we corrected that as well, third world country, this report would be it. So I was interested in what third world countries I was thinking we were. So we looked at third world countries around the world, and this is a map of third world countries. Mostly the green ones are usually considered the third world, the yellow ones don't. But Medicines Australia has added third world. They've added England, Scotland, Ireland, Sweden, Canada and other countries. The peaks, of course, have been added in. Japan is all third world countries. New Zealand, of course, we all know that New Zealand has got a lot of problems, some of them associated, not always associated with being a third world country. Anyway, so Minister Plibersek said, the idea you can just pick and choose elements of other countries' systems and that automatically gives us a better, stronger system is incorrect. So there is a lot of literature about whether countries can learn from each other. And so this is an important theoretical issue which I'll discuss more in my lecture at ANU. But we were selective in what of New Zealand, Western Australia and the other state we actually chose to adopt. So I think it is not true that you can't learn from other countries. And I think we can and we should. We can also, the Commonwealth can also learn from some of the states, which is probably a bit more difficult than to learn from other countries. So in Australian public hospitals, companies are happy to take a very low price so that when patients go into community, they stay on that particular brand of medicine. Well, there's little evidence that the companies are making a loss doing that. In fact, certainly it doesn't explain the lower prices in New Zealand. So the argument of a loss leader is actually not borne out by the New Zealand evidence, nor necessarily by the hospital evidence, because sometimes the patients are on those drugs when they come into the hospital. Then, New Zealand is a basket case when it comes to access to medicines. It's the last place health policymakers in this country should be looking to for ideas. Now, the issue of access to medicine is only relevant to the patented drugs because with respect to the generics, which is where the vast bulk of our savings are, there's no issue of access because they've got exactly the same access. And so it's not relevant to our proposed generic pricing. And it is true, though, that New Zealand does have lower access and a lag time with getting new drugs on the market. And that is true. So that component, that this is a policy issue that needs to be addressed, and it's partly addressed by where you set the price, or where you set the budget. But it's not true that they've had no increase in drugs. And, you know, if you look at some of the major classes of drugs, of New Zealand, like Australia, is having a significant increase in drug utilisation, but they're doing it cheaply. And I said the expenditure is almost flat, but it's important to point out to you there's been a 15% increase in expenditure in real terms. Then we have Australian suppliers of generic medicines already sell their medicines at international world's best prices due to very competitive generic medicines industry in Australia. Our concerns are unfounded as price disclosure ensures that the government benefits. And there's similar statements from the Health Minister and so on. Well, patently it's not true. I mean, we see when we actually look at the data that it's just not true, and also when you look at our policies, it's just not the best practice in the world. And then it is true that New Zealand does get a good price for generic medicines, which is actually inconsistent with that, but they have a great deal less choice for patients. Now, of course, the issue is choice by itself here, and then the argument of rhetoric of choice was very important in some of the responses. Choice is, in fact, not a preeminent value. Just think about patented medicines. You don't have a choice with patented medicines because government across the world has made a decision to trade off choice to reward innovation, which I think is the right thing to do. So you think about choice not being always the best thing. And, of course, choice is supposed to be part of a competitive ideal and lead to savings. And it doesn't in this case. Now, our model does not propose the elimination of choice. But I'll just put this to you. On the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, there are 13 brands of atorvastatin. All are listed at the same price. All are listed in the new list at $52.62. And so that the patient pays $36.10, who's not on concession and not safety net. So if you went out and did a survey of patients and said, even patients who are on atorvastatin, would you prefer to have a choice of 13 types of atorvastatin, or would you prefer to have $22 savings in your pocket every time you filled that box, or every time you got that box from the pharmacist? I'm not sure whether they would all vote in favour of having 13 brands and no patient benefit versus one or two or three or four or five brands and a $22 saving. Other concerns were lower income for retail pharmacists. You'll see the Pharmacy Guild are traipsing the corridors of Parliament today advocating greater income for pharmacists. But the retail pharmacy income will already disclose from price disclosure. We haven't taken those savings into account. But we have said that our savings would impact about $20,000 per pharmacy. And if this is an issue, and it's unclear to us whether it is going to be an issue particularly in rural Australia, in which case you might need to restructure the subsidy arrangements. And there might be a loss of research and development in Australia. It's not at all clear that will be the case. But in any case, if you look at the types of research and development that take place in Australia in the drug industry, most of it is in phase 3 clinical trials. Compared to the United States, where there's about the same amount of investment in phase 3 clinical trials as there is in basic discovery research. So we've already lost the game, and our exposure to clinical trial research is phase 3 clinical trials, is we're highly exposed to that because other countries develop their capacities in that area. And in any event, there's no evidence that paying high prices in a country influences the choice of where people do clinical trials, and it would seem to me that direct strategies to support R&D are preferred to indirect ones. So what did we recommend? That's what we recommended. Start by getting the foundations right, tough rules on generic pricing, promote cost-effective choices. We'd save, certainly with stage 1 and 2, at least $1.3 billion, and then possibly $550 million thereafter. Thank you very much. I'm out of questions.
Any questions?
Hi, my name's Eloise with the Financial Review. I was just wondering, given the MOU expires in 2016.
Yeah.
Then have you spoken to the opposition about your report and the reforms that you've suggested? And if so, are they critical of the reforms, or do they accept the
I've briefed the opposition, but I haven't asked them to disclose to me and to the world what their policies are.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. We'll keep digging then.
Patrick Toden from Catholic Health Australia. In terms of the $1.3 billion savings, have you worked out the proportion that would go to the budget and the proportion that would go to individuals?
Thanks, Patrick. The answer is no, we haven't, because that data, it's not possible to get that information from what's available. Roughly speaking, about 85% of pharmaceutical benefit scheme total spending is government spending, and about 15% consumer spending. But we don't know the distribution of that by drug, but you can guess it's about 85-15. This is what we've said, but we've expressed our savings in total savings.
Just to add to that, that wouldn't necessarily follow, though, because if most of the savings accrue to non-concession card holders who pay that differential amount of $36 rather than $5.50, so wouldn't the savings be more so to non-concession card holding individuals?
I can't tell. You know, one of the problems is some of these drugs, like atorvastatin, is a chronic disease sort of drug, and so they might have hit the safety net by the end of the year, even if they're above the safety net at the start of the year. To the extent that, so the high volume drugs, which are where the big savings are, may well be skewed towards concession card holders, but it's speculation.
Just to continue on that, I mean, the general fairly rough rule that I'd applied was that any savings between what a non-concession card holder and a concession card holder is paying out of pocket, about a third of that saving should accrue to those that don't have a concession card as cold hard cash, and the rest of that savings accrues to government if generic prices are falling from somewhere between $36 and $5.50, it should all be going to government. So in theory, I would have argued that a non-concession card holding individual would get a third of the savings.
Yeah.
In very broad terms, most generic drugs would be under $36 and above $5.
Yeah. The most of the generics under this proposal would go way under the 36, and could go to the 5, in which case government would get $30 benefit on everyone. In addition to what they get above the 36, so
the proportion of the population that have a concession card.
Yeah.
And then for that remainder, assuming that they are equally likely to be on the treatment, which is not the case, that all would accrue to the individual.
Yes, exactly. So it could be, it's going to be both. But in any event, it's significant to both.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions? We've got Benji. Benji first, and then Linda. And then
you. Amanda Biggs from Parliamentary Library. I just wondered if you could expand a little bit more on the price disclosure arrangements and what time period do you think would be a better time period to aim for? I think you explained that in total there's about an 18-month time lapse between the initial part of the process and the final part of the process. So how long do you think that should reasonably take?
So,
now, what sort of savings could we make by accelerating that process further?
Well, it's difficult to know what sort of savings. I mean, it really depends. The savings depend on the disclosures, but certainly an 18-month period puts a huge lag in the whole process. This minimum of 12 months,
especially for a price guarantee, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a price guarantee, and you know, other discounts might occur after the disclosure date, so you're always playing catch up. But it seems to me absurd to allow 12 months for a process which involves downloading computer information onto a spreadsheet and sending it off to the department. So you could easily, in my view, shrink that to 3 months.
Did you look at what other countries do?
They don't have a process like this.
So we really
And you could, this is the consultant and the department making a decision. So, I mean, I thought that you could shrink that whole process down to 6 months without doing great violence, and then you could do it twice. Then you could actually make the announcements twice a year rather than just once. They only make the announcements once a year. So you could really speed it up, I think. And that, if you wanted an interim sort of policy solution, that would certainly be one.
Just on that point, when the legislation was being debated, the Greens actually put up an amendment to reduce the time frame, but ended up withdrawing it.
Did they say what?
I can't remember, but I do remember that there was certainly an amendment that was put up and then withdrawn. And Korea actually had a similar approach, but after about 18 months to 2 years, stopped it. Mm-hmm. And it was just before Australia introduced theirs, which I thought was interesting. Just a question, if I may, in terms of calculation of the total drug budget, what sort of principles would you envisage be guiding that sort of setting of the global budget?
Well, the budget setting process is always complex, especially with things like the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. At the moment, there's no budget that's just totally and completely open-ended. It would seem to me that you should be, I know that the hospital pricing system fell into disrepute recently, but it seems to me that you ought to be taking those sorts of things into account, age and sex of the population and how that changes, but also how pricing could be expected to change, which is in the hospital funding formula, plus also a technology factor, which is in the hospital pricing. So you build into the budget setting process the expectation that you're going to be having to respond to new technologies and new drug discoveries, but then you say, well, that's what you have to live with. And so it shouldn't just be last year plus 3%, the copper sort of approach, which would be not a good strategy.
Ed Holland from the Senate Community Affairs Committee Secretary. Being a little ignorant about some of this material, I wasn't able to follow your run through some of the counter-arguments towards the end. But there was one that attracted my attention. I was just hoping you could step us through in a little more detail, which was a loss leader argument.
So, what the minister says
in public hospitals and the sales and community. Can you step us through how that works and why that's a relevant issue here?
So public hospitals supply drugs to inpatients and to some extent outpatients, but supply drugs to inpatients and are not allowed to charge the cost of those drugs against the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. So the public hospital itself has to purchase drugs for use with inpatients. And that is also true of public... So the public hospitals purchase those drugs, and we got data from Western Australia and also from an unnamed state about the prices they paid. So the minister's argument is this, that one of the reasons that the drug companies would be prepared to give low prices to public hospitals is that if a person goes into a public hospital with a new event, say a heart failure of some kind, and then is placed on a drug in the public hospital, then when they go out of the public hospital, they'd be more likely to stay on exactly the same brand of drug that they got in the public hospital, rather than being swapped to a different brand of the same drug. And so the pharmaceutical manufacturers would then have an incentive to lower the price in the public hospitals so they would capture market share when those patients are discharged. So that's what the minister is arguing here, that companies are happy to take a very low price so that when the patients get discharged and go back into the community, they stay on that particular brand of medicine, thus increasing the market share of the pharmaceutical manufacturer.
Okay, your point being that... is the implication that the minister's making there that if we were to try and lower the PBS price, it would force them to raise the public hospital price?
No.
Is this about cost subsidy?
I think her argument is that the pharmaceutical manufacturers One of my staff, or one of the staff of the Grattan Institute, took the view that the pharmaceutical manufacturers were just being generous and charitable to the public hospitals, and they were so kind-hearted, they were giving low prices, and that was his view of why this was his argument. But her argument would be this line of argument would be that the pharmaceutical manufacturers would not be as generous in their negotiations with the pharmaceutical benefit scheme because there was no incentive to expand their market share that they would get. Now, the other weakness that I didn't say here is that the drugs that we compared were generic drugs, basically, with Western Australia. There doesn't seem any reason, and as I said here, it doesn't explain lower prices in New Zealand. Does that answer your question? Does it?
I think so, but I'll
you're still puzzling.
It's a non-argument, really.
It's a non-argument. Okay. Well, that's sort of what we're saying.
I guess the other comment is, as you mentioned, that in fact, in a lot of cases, it's patients going in.
Yes, it happens.
Particularly all the chronic disease things.
They're already using.
They're already using a drug. They go into hospital while they're in hospital. The public hospital is giving them that same drug. Yeah.
They can take. Many public hospitals would let them bring their tablets in with them, but people might forget, or they might run out, or whatever, and so they just get the public hospital supply. So this argument, in fact, doesn't apply for that reason as well. Andrew,
John. Well, Stephen, I don't know, I was just going to ask, when you said they had this agreement when the drug comes off patent with the Pharmacy of Medicines Australia, of a 16% lowering. As a minimum. What stops the pharmacy side of things from taking a lower price? Like, you get a warehouse pharmacy, as you know, competing now. What stops me from a warehouse pharmacy saying, well, the hell with the 16%, I'll take it down, whatever.
Nothing. There's nothing. But only the warehouse pharmacies do that. Most of the retail pharmacies don't.
So what you're saying is, even though the government's, and I'm asking, so I'm still a bit blurred on this myself, right?
So you just gave a speech on this on Monday or Tuesday, I did, thought.
Yeah, but that was not so much on generics. That's where we've got a blockage.
Yeah, I know.
Novel drugs, which is a problem, of course. But the reason that blockage is created by the government, I understand, is because of the cost of damn generics, where we're not getting the same. So I'm not disputing what you're saying, and it's not contrary to what you're saying. It's just a different, where I'm picking that rent up and looking at that, as you understand. But what I'm saying is, even though we said 16%, there's nothing to stop, really, the Pharmacy Guild having an agreement with its pharmacists to charge a much lower rate than they are currently.
To negotiate a better deal from the suppliers. And many of them are, which is what price disclosure is about. But the question is, they're not passing that on, generally, to the consumer.
Yes, and I didn't like going, because that's not part of my speech, but that's sort of what I was feeling.
But the reality, my argument is the 1.3, there are a lot of drugs that have been delayed and not coming onto the schedule, and it's going to be worse in the future because of the genomics and so on. The 1.3 billion, at least part of it, ought to be used to fix up some of the lags.
Yes, yeah.
You know, shifting the profit, or shifting the spending from generic to innovating.
Yes. And look, that's what my speech was more designed that end, because the new biologics, which are the main new drugs coming through, are all generally fairly damned expensive and to a narrow audience, you know what I mean, the more designer drugs. And the worry is, because we're squandering money on the generics, I think, and I agree totally with you, by the way, we're not disputing that, but I think we could probably fix it up if the Pharmacy Guild and others had a look at this and said, look, we'll be dinkum about this and diversify and don't need to screw the public so much on these generic drugs. I'm glad Cos is not an audience, is he, mate? But what do you think of that comment?
As I said, there's a couple of points you're making. First is, we should be shifting money from the generics into the, we're spending too much on the generics. Yes. We may be spending too much on the innovators, but it's not nearly as much. And we have got drugs that aren't being listed or delayed in listing that we ought to be listing. So that's I agree with you to that extent. And the second thing is, the more we can put pressure, the trouble is, individual consumers would find it hard to put pressure on their local pharmacy Maybe, though. It depends whether they're in a very competitive situation, how close the nearest pharmacy is to say, you know, what are you prepared to do a deal on this particular drug? Norman Swan, on the Health Report on Monday night, had a story about a guy in Canberra who went shopping to see what the best prices were, and it was a pretty sorry tale. So we might be able to get better deals for the consumers resting on consumer power, but I'm not sure that we could. Can we then trust the Pharmacy Guild to, you know, charitably, try and reduce the prices? Well, some of the generic suppliers are actually owned by chemist chains, Chemmart and so on, so it might be feasible. Yeah.
Maybe I can just add in, I mean, I referred to it as the suicide gene in the PBS in 2005, and this suicide gene is the fact that we pay for therapeutic outcome in this country.
Okay.
We don't pay a competitive price. So if we've agreed that the price to look after your hypertension is $56, the PBS, until we had the mandatory price cut under Tony Abbott, was blind to whether it was a generic or an innovator doing that job. It'll pay up to $56. And this is the issue. Why would you negotiate a better price if anything from $56 down to $55.50 would be paid fully by the government,
yes,
whether it's a generic or not? There's simply no incentive to do anything else than take the raw price of the drug and capture everything up to $55.50 and share that surplus between the person who delivers or manufactures the drug and the person who sells it. So that surplus is simply being divided up in various ways all around the country. So that's the problem.
And not to the consumer.
That's right.
Or the taxpayer.
So the question I had for you, Stephen, was, we've talked a fair bit about what might happen if generic prices were to fall, but the first thing we've discussed is the viability of regional pharmacies. Good, that's an important issue. The second one is, what would GPs and pharmacists do in the firing line now? Because you've removed the incentive for a pharmacist to sell a generic drug because they don't capture any surplus anymore, because there is no surplus. So now, what do we have? Potentially, we're moving back to using innovators instead, because pharmacists cease to push a generic. So that's the first little
shift. But if the price is low, Andrew, do you care whether it's an innovator or the generic who...
That's the problem. The pharmacist no longer cares.
But does the government... If the government gets a really good price deal...
Yes.
If I take,
yes,
New Zealand and atorvastatin,
yes,
it's actually Pfizer who supplies in New Zealand at that low price. So they were the innovator. And so...
Yes.
And they make their generic. Yes.
And they make a generic version. But should government care whether it's Pfizer or Kemba,
no, but my
as long as it's paying a good deal, getting a good low price.
No, the point I'm making is that at the moment, when you think about it, there's a $55 price for an innovator. The manufacturer gets most of that. The overwhelming majority of that is taken by the drug manufacturer, and there's not much in it for the pharmacist. But if there's a generic right next to it on the shelf, selling for $54, and the pharmacist gets nearly half of that in the pocket, well, of course they will do what they can to push the generic. So we are currently at about 30 to 35% generic prescribing. The rest of the developed world is nearly double. So my first question is, how do we keep pharmacists interested in using generic drugs once you take away their surplus? And secondly, how are we going to start talking to GPs about increasing generic prescribing?
Yeah, well, the latter point is a really, really important one. And how do you do that? That, you know, sending out the details and so on, you know, the local education of GPs hasn't been terribly successful.
Financial incentive.
Sorry?
Financial incentive.
Yeah, I mean, the AMA, I think, would die in a ditch about giving GPs a drug budget and a financial incentive. Not that I think it's a... what's the downside in that, you might say? I wouldn't say that, but... But
I need your views on it. That's,
yeah.
So this is like effectively benchmarking generic prescription,
yeah,
and identifying who are the high prescribers.
Well, you could provide them feedback on what their prescribing rates are. I mean, it's something we are going to be turning our mind to, because this issue of low generic prescribing rates, Australia is a standout, as you pointed out, Andrew, and it's really a very good policy question. I haven't had enough time to turn my mind to what would be the best strategy to actually address that. And certainly financial incentives on GPs could work. I'll need to look at the literature on that. Education hasn't tended to work. Financial incentives for consumers has worked. So the combination. But as I said earlier, if the government gets the prices down, and it could say, in the atorvastatin example, well, we can still have 13 people on the 13 manufacturers on the list, but you're only going to get $5.80 or whatever it is. And it doesn't seem to matter whether it's a generic brand or a Pfizer brand that they use. So as long as government's getting a good deal and the patient's getting a good deal.
On that note, if we have no final questions, let's wrap up the session. Stephen, thank you very much for coming in and giving the presentation and answering the various questions. Thank you very much.
And our full report's available on the Grattan website. Thanks. Thanks, Andrew, for coming.
Thank you very much.
It's good. It's a nice piece. Do a few of the generic
That's right.